down and told her he did not see himself married or as a father. He promised he would send her money, but he never did. Jolie now had a 4-year-old boy to take care of. Fortunately, she had a mother who was willing to help out. Calloway found her attractive, and he almost convinced her to go out with him. But the moment she became aware of his history, her interest vanished. He reminded her too much of her ex-husband. Calloway had left his wife and daughter to pursue a life of adventure, and he was always behind in his child support payments. He was what she despised in men. They were always looking for a good time, but never wanted the responsibility that went with it. She warmed up to him when she found out about the cases he was involved in, the most important being the murder of Julia Seaborn. Julia's body was found underneath Milton's Westgate Bridge. When her case turned cold, her family hired Calloway to find her killer. Calloway's search led him to Fairview, and with the help of a reporter, he not only solved Julia's murder, but also another girl's. Calloway had hoped the case would be his calling card to fame and fortune, and that he would work on more intriguing cases from then on. Unfortunately, not everyone thought private investigators were reliable in solving serious crimes. They trusted the police detectives to do the job. When the money from the Seaborn case ran out, Calloway went back to photographing cheaters and adulterers. Calloway sighed. "I'm not working on anything worth talking about. What have you been up to?"
"I got a call from a music producer," Julie replied with a wide smile.
"You did?" he asked, surprised.
"He's only worked with local talent, but it could lead to something big, right?"
"Definitely. But how did you find him?"
"He found me. I started posting songs online, which I shared on my social media page. People started listening to them, and they started sharing them with their friends and families. It's not a big following, only a couple hundred people, but I figured I have to start somewhere, you know?" Calloway smiled.
"Yeah, sure. Good for you. Congrats."
"You're just saying that so I will go out with you." He shook his head.
"No, I really mean it. I hope this is your big break."
Calloway knew she desperately wanted a better life for herself and her son. It must not be easy raising a kid on her own. He felt like human waste for the way he had treated his ex-wife. If he could go back and change one thing, it would be the way he walked away from his marriage. Jolie was now beaming. "You know, you just made my day. And for that, you get a free coffee."
"Can I get something to eat, too? I'm short on cash."
"Fine, but this is the last time. Bill is already on my case for giving freebies to customers," Jolie replied.
Bill was a somewhat stingy manager with a by-the-book attitude.
Calloway smiled again.
"You have a heart of gold and a voice of an angel."
Jolie smiled back. "Stop it. Flattery will not get you an extra meal."
Calloway looked around and found the morning newspaper on a stool. He was flipping through the pages when his breakfast came. It was eggs with toast. There was also a cup of piping hot coffee.
"Enjoy," Jolie said.
"Thanks, I will." He dug in like he had not eaten in days. The plate was empty in a matter of minutes. He was sipping coffee when he saw what was on the diner's TV. "Do you mind turning up the volume?" he asked Jolie. The TV was showing a police press conference. He recognized Detective Greg Holt, and behind him was Detective Dana Fisher. Microphones were shoved in front of Holt. "Must be another murder," Calloway thought. Calloway lifted the coffee cup to his lips, but then he quickly set the cup down. He squinted. He then got up and went around the counter, his eye still glued to the TV. The set was an older model placed on a top shelf. Calloway closed in until he was inches away from the screen.
"Hey, you're blocking the view!"
a middle-aged man at the counter shouted. But Calloway was transfixed. He was staring at the house in the background.
"You okay, Lee?" Jolie asked.
Without answering her, he turned around and rushed out of the diner. Chapter 12. He was dressed in a $2,000 Italian suit. His shoes were the finest leather money could buy. He was clean-shaven, and his hair was slicked back.
On his wrist was a gold watch with a dial encrusted in diamonds. Evan Roth was a high-priced lawyer. His clientele were individuals with a net worth in the millions. He earned his B.A. magna cum laude from Cambridge University and his law degree from Yale University. His father, Ezra, was a well-known lawyer who kept the infamous mobster, Lou Shotgun Marconi, out of prison. Marconi got the nickname after he had mowed down a group of rival gang members outside a barber shop. Ezra had suddenly died in the middle of his closing argument in a high-profile case. Some said he got exactly what he deserved for the way he kept murderers, rapists, and even citizens charged with treason from getting the death penalty. Roth was in court the day his father fell to the floor in front of the jury. He was as shocked as everyone else. His father was a model of good health. He ate well, he exercised regularly, he even stayed away from tobacco and alcohol. What killed him, Roth found out later, was a heart defect. His father worked 70 to 80 hours a week. He lived and breathed law. Every day he was not in court was a bad day for him. This led him to miss his regular health checkups. Had he gone to the doctor even once, his heart condition would have been noticed, and perhaps he would still be alive. Roth did not look back in regret. His father was a smart man, and he died doing what he loved. Roth, however, learned from his father's mistakes. He chose not to represent individuals with violent histories, such as drug lords, serial killers, or terrorists. The exposure he could get from such cases would be great, but not the pay. Instead, he went after clients with legit money and who found themselves in difficult situations. Paul Gardner was such a person. He sat across the table from Roth with his head bowed. Paul had the look Roth had seen too many times over his career. Shocked, confused, and scared. Shocked because he never imagined he would be in this position. Confused because he did not know why it happened to him. Scared because he did not know what was going to happen next. In Roth's experience, it was the innocent that felt the severe effects of the various stages of emotions. Their shock, confusion, and fear was genuine. To them, this was a nightmare that they could not wait to wake up from. Roth believed all his clients were innocent. If he did not, that would make his job more difficult. He never asked his clients if they had done what they were accused of, even if they tried to confess to him. He simply told them he was the wrong man to confess to. If they wanted to admit their guilt, they should tell the police. Roth's job was to defend his clients and prove them innocent. The jury needed to see the conviction in Roth's eyes. If he argued his client's innocence, the jury needed to believe him. And to believe him, they needed to trust him. The only way for that to happen was for him to lay out the facts in such a way that the jury had no choice but to give a verdict of not guilty. Roth unlocked his designer briefcase and pulled out a legal pad. From his suit pocket, he removed a gold-plated pen. "Tell me what happened last night," he said. Chapter 13. The press conference had ended when Calloway showed up. To his surprise, the reporters had not dispersed. He realized why when he saw them huddled around Detective Holt. Calloway had had a few run-ins with Holt, and if you asked him, they were not pleasant. To say Holt did not like private investigators would be an understatement. Holt had said to Calloway there was no use for people like him. Crime was the police's business. Calloway always replied that with the crime rate so high and the solve rate so low, there was definitely a need for people like him. The police had limited resources, and there was only so much they could do to solve a case. If a private investigator was working in tandem with them, there was no telling how fast a case could be solved. Calloway had even proposed during one of their brief encounters that the Milton PD hire him as a consultant. Holt had shot down the idea, even before Calloway had finished his sentence. There was no way he would take such an absurd idea to his superiors. Calloway could not entirely blame him, though. Thanks to his time as a deputy sheriff, Calloway knew the rules and regulations a detective had to follow in order to solve a case. The arrest must be in accordance to procedures. The evidence must be attained within certain guidelines. A witness must not be coerced into providing a statement in favor of the prosecution. Without these policies, a case could be thrown out of court. Calloway was not bound by any rules except his own. He knew right from wrong. His time in the sheriff's office also gave him the ability to discern what was admissible in court and what was not. But he also was not afraid to bend the rules from time to time in order to solve a case. When clients hired Calloway, they were fully aware they were hiring not a police officer, but a person who was willing to go above and beyond to solve their problems. No police officer would sit in a cold vehicle for hours to catch an adulterer. Their time was better spent on a stakeout to catch a big-time drug dealer or a high-profile criminal. Maybe that's why Calloway was always struggling for money. People did not value the service he provided to them. He should have known better when he chose to go independent. He was moving around the crowd when he spotted a familiar figure standing in the corner. Detective Fisher had her arms crossed over her chest and a frown on her face. "Why so sad?" Calloway asked, walking up to her. Her frown melted when she saw him. "Lee, what are you doing here?" "I figured I'd drop by and see what all the commotion is about," he replied. Calloway and Fisher had once dated. That was another reason Holt did not like him very much. He was new to the city, and she was single and available. She realized at that time that Calloway was not serious about a long-term relationship. She felt he was still dealing with unresolved issues stemming from his marriage. "You caught the press conference on TV?" she asked. "Live and in full color." Fisher shook her head. "I don't think it's a good idea, but Holt disagrees." "He's relishing every minute in front of the cameras," Calloway said, looking in Holt's direction. "It's not his fault. The department has been under a lot of pressure from the public, the media, and the mayor. They keep cutting our budget, but they still expect us to meet our mandate." "Oh, the travesty," Calloway quipped. Fisher laughed, knowing Calloway was just joking. Calloway had been through his share of cutbacks when he was in the sheriff's department. In fact, police department cutbacks were the topic of the first conversation between them. Fisher was at a party hosted by a friend of hers when Calloway approached her. He knew someone at the party as well, and over a round of drinks they hit on a topic that they were both passionate about. She was furious that the government was willing to give tax breaks to the wealthy, but not invest more money in those who protected the general population. He did not disagree with her, but he also expressed his belief that people got the politicians they deserved. After all, it was they who elected them. Fisher said, "Holt feels this case is a slam dunk, so he wants the public to see the good job we are doing at the Milton PD." "So is it a slam dunk?" Calloway asked with a raised eyebrow. Her eyes narrowed. "Why are you so interested, Lee?" "Let's say I may have a vested interest in what happens." She blinked. "Do you mind explaining what that means?" "I wish I could, but I can't," he replied. "So what evidence do you have against Paul Gardner?"
"I wish I could tell you, but I can't."
He grinned. "Touché. Can you at least tell me where he is?"
"Milton PD."
"He got a lawyer yet?"
"The moment we charged him. It's Evan Roth.
He's good and expensive."
"It's the guilty who hire the best lawyers money can buy."
"I'm not going to argue with that," he said, moving away from her.
"Where are you going?" she asked.
"I need to talk to Roth."
Chapter 14. Roth stood before the reporters who were assembled outside the Milton Police Department. He could have made a statement at some other location, but he knew the value of optics. He wanted the public, correction, potential jury, to see where they were keeping his client. The building resembled a giant concrete block. The structure was gray, cold, and uninviting. No person would want to spend even a minute inside there. But his client, an upstanding citizen of Milton, was locked up inside. The narrative was vital in cases of this nature. The police wanted to show there was overwhelming evidence against the accused. Roth's job was to refute this so-called evidence. The press conference held by the detectives outside the victim's residence was nothing more than an attempt to make a statement. The victim lived and died in a place that she called home. She had also died at the hands of someone who was meant to protect her.
her father. Roth waited as the reporters rushed to prepare themselves. Batteries were checked on voice recorders. Camera lenses were double-checked for the perfect shot. Video equipment was adjusted and readjusted to capture the right angle. Roth loved every minute. This was why he chose to follow his father's footsteps and become a criminal defense lawyer. He relished the surge of adrenaline he felt at the start of a new case, and on top of that, there was the money. His fees were exorbitant, but most clients would pay just about anything to get out of the predicament they were in. Roth was what stood between their freedom and a life inside a concrete cell. Roth started with a standard opening. "I have just spoken to my client. He is doing well under the circumstances. He is shocked and upset by the death of his daughter. He is a devoted father and a loving husband. Now I will take a few questions." Hands shot up in the air. Roth had already scanned the group for reporters who asked tough questions and those who did not, who wrote favorable stories on the cases about his defendants and who did not, who was biased and who was not. He pointed to one reporter, who quickly asked, "What do you have to say regarding the evidence against your client?" "The prosecution has not yet provided me with a list of the charges against my client. It is something I will be asking the DA's office right after I leave here." Another hand shot up. "Is it true your client was caught red-handed?" Roth made a dramatic face, but his expression was more for the cameras than a reaction to the question. Roth had prepared himself for every question imaginable. "I'm not sure where this rumor was started, and if I were you, I would check my sources. My client is an upstanding citizen who has donated thousands of dollars to the local community. He has a very successful business, and a majority of his employees are from this city." "Why would the Milton Police Department make an announcement so suddenly if they did not believe your client was guilty of the crime?" another reporter asked. Roth almost chuckled, as if the question was beyond absurd. "This is something you will have to ask the fine officers at the Milton PD. I have no idea. My client has never been charged with any crime in his entire life, not even a speeding ticket. This entire ordeal has been nothing short of a nightmare for him. He has lost his only child, whom he deeply cares about. He would rather be with his wife, mourning this tragic loss, than be alone inside a cold prison cell." Another hand shot up. "When will you be requesting bail?" "We are hoping to go before a judge later today, so that my client can be home with his family." Roth answered a couple of questions that were in the same vein as the previous ones. He finished by saying, "We intend to fight vigorously any and all charges against my client." He walked away from the group of reporters with a smile on his face. His goal was to get the message across that his client was not the person the police had made him out to be, and he felt he had accomplished this, and much more. Chapter 15. Calloway had watched the question and answer session with great interest. Lawyers were a particular breed. They revealed only what was necessary and what would win them the case. Calloway's clients were mostly wives who had hired him to dig up dirt on their rich husbands. That information was then used to extricate a divorce settlement that was in their favor. This gave Calloway a front-row seat when it came to lawyers. He had more than his share of run-ins with them, and the experience was something he would rather avoid. Provided with proof of their clients' infidelities, the husband's lawyers often threatened to sue Calloway and his clients for absurd amounts of money. They tried to get the judge to dismiss the evidence in court, arguing that it violated their client's right to privacy. They even went so far as to try to have Calloway charged for voyeurism. Calloway tried to take it all in stride. The lawyers were paid handsomely to defend their clients, and even with hard evidence, photographs of their clients caught in uncompromising positions, they did everything in their power to have that evidence ruled inadmissible in court. When they attacked Calloway's character, however, was when he took it personally. They would speak of his infidelities. They would mention his gambling habits. They would show his run-ins with the law. Calloway had been booked for disorderly conduct on a few occasions, and if you asked him, he blamed the booze for his behavior, anything to discredit him and his work. Fortunately, the presiding judges would counter that it was their clients who were on trial, not Calloway. Also, Calloway was careful in the manner he went about his business. The photos were taken from outside the rendezvous point. He never tried to hide inside a closet to get the perfect shot. It was not his fault if some people did not pull the drapes before they began frolicking in bed. He never planted hidden cameras or tapped telephones. He was smart enough to know anything procured illegally would not hold up as evidence. The last thing he wanted was to do anything that would leave his clients in a worse position than when they hired him. He watched as Roth made his way to a shiny Bentley. He hurried to catch up with him. "Mr. Roth," Calloway said, "I need to speak to you." Roth was typing away on his cell phone when he turned. He eyed Calloway up and down and said, "You can make an appointment with my secretary." He did not even bother offering his business card. Calloway's rumpled attire did not give off the impression he could afford his services. "It's about Paul Gardner." Roth's eyes narrowed. "What about him?" "I need to speak to him." "Are you a lawyer?" "No, I'm a private investigator." Roth frowned. "I already have a PI on my payroll, so I don't need another." "I'm not looking for a job." "Then what are you looking for? Money?" "More money would be nice, but your client already gave me some." Roth blinked. "What?" "Your client is my client." "Okay, now I am even more confused." "Your client hired me for a job, and that's why I need to speak to him."
"What was the job?"
"I can't say."
"Then no, you can't speak to my client."
Roth moved toward his car. "It's about last night," Calloway said. Roth stopped.
"What about it?"
Calloway was silent. He was not sure how much he could reveal just yet. Roth asked,
"Was my client with you last night? Are you his alibi?"
"No."
"Then you can't help him escape lethal injection, because that's what the prosecution will ask for. Murder in the first degree, which will automatically qualify him for the death penalty."
"Call your client," Calloway said. "Ask him if he is willing to speak to me." Roth stared at him, still unsure. "I have something that is of great interest to your client, but first I need to show it to him. If he gives me his approval, then I'll show it to you." Roth exhaled.
"Fine. What's your name?"
Chapter 16. Roth made the call. He then took Calloway inside Milton PD, but only because they were already standing next to the station. Roth's time was too valuable, and he did not like anyone wasting it. The accused was allowed access to legal counsel at any time, including anyone on his lawyer's legal team. Roth introduced Calloway to the desk sergeant as a member from his firm. Before leaving, Roth warned him, "Don't make me regret this." Calloway had no intention of getting in the crosshairs of Evan Roth. He had his own share of problems to deal with and did not need another. Unlike regular visitors, Calloway did not have to go through a rigorous screening. The sergeant did, however, review the items Calloway had on him. He held up a camera and asked, "What's this for?" "Well, I wish to take photos of the accused in case you rough him up," Calloway quipped. The sergeant's eyes hardened. Police brutality had always been an issue, and thanks to cell phone cameras, it was a hot topic. In this day and age, no police officer could so much as slap a suspect without some civilian bystander recording the act on a smartphone. But the officer had no reason to disallow Calloway's camera, so he grunted and gave the camera back. Calloway was given a visitor's pass and was made to sign a ledger. He was then escorted into a windowless room. When the door slammed shut behind him, Calloway immediately regretted coming here. The walls were painted dark gray, and over the years, grime had accumulated on them. The floor was rough and concrete. The table was metal, but it was covered in scratches. The room suddenly felt hot and stuffy. Perspiration broke out under Calloway's collar, and he began to feel like he was suffocating. He closed his eyes and took a deep breath. It did not help that the space smelled of sweat and urine. He suddenly had the urge to run out of the room and never come back. He was relieved to hear the door open and see Paul Gardner come in. He was wearing an orange jumpsuit. His hands were shackled, and he had a day-old growth of beard on his cheeks. His eyes were raw.
He must have been crying before they let him here, Calloway thought.
Gardner sat down across from him, and the officer removed the cuffs around his wrists. The officer left the room before shutting the door behind him. Calloway stared at Gardner, and suddenly felt overwhelming guilt. He could get up and leave at any time he wanted, while Paul had no choice. Whatever Calloway had felt coming to the Milton PD, Paul was feeling it 10 times worse.
"How are you, Paul?" Calloway finally asked.
Paul rubbed his hands.
"I'm good, I guess."
"You know I am here," he nodded.
"I forgot about it until I saw you just now. I've had an eventful day."
"I know."
They were silent a moment. Calloway said,
"We don't have to do this now. We can always do it later. But I figured I should show it to you. You did hire me for a job."
Paul sighed.
"I'm not sure what use it has now. I've got bigger problems to deal with. Do you know they are charging me with murdering my own daughter?"
"I heard," Calloway replied.
Paul lowered his head.
"I would never hurt Kyla. She was my baby. I don't even..."
Calloway put his hand up to stop him.
"I'm not your lawyer, Paul. Client-attorney privilege doesn't come into play with me. If I am subpoenaed, I will have to disclose our discussion in court."
Paul nodded.
"Okay. Show me," he said.
Calloway pulled out the camera, turned it so Paul could see the LCD screen, and began to scroll through the photos. The picture showed Sharon Gardner leaving the house and driving away in the middle of the night. They then showed her arriving at an apartment building. 2 hours later, they showed her leaving the building with another man. Paul stared at the last image.
"Do you know him?" Calloway asked.
"No."
Calloway leaned forward.
"I think it would be best if Evan Roth saw them."
"Why? What good would it do? I had a feeling my wife was being unfaithful, and I wanted to see proof of it. I thought it might help me in the divorce."
He shook his head.
"That's the least of my worries now."
"As a former deputy sheriff, I am familiar with how investigations go. The detectives will be getting statements from everyone who was at your house last night, which means you and your wife. And it might end up including me, because I was also there. I don't want to explain myself to them without you seeing what I found first."
Paul said nothing, but he still stared at the image. Calloway could not imagine what he must be going through. His daughter was dead. His wife was cheating on him, and he was stuck in a 6x6 cell. He looked like the loneliest person on the planet.
"Just show it to your lawyer," Calloway said. "It might mean nothing, or it might mean everything."
Chapter 17. The district attorney's office was located on the 8th floor of a government building, and like many government buildings, it was massive, imposing, and ugly. The office of the DA, however, was the polar opposite. It was spacious, colorfully decorated, and the windows did not have any drapes or shades, allowing natural light to flow in. District Attorney Judy Barrows was in her 60s. She had a wiry frame and deeply etched skin. Her teeth were stained yellow from many years of heavy smoking. Her eyes were small and narrow, but were always focused and steady. During a cross-examination, if she had you in her gaze, you could not look away. Barrows had graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree from Cornell University. She received her Juris Doctor from the University of Michigan Law School. When she moved to Milton, she took a job in the DA's office, quickly moving up to become the Chief Deputy District Attorney, until finally becoming the District Attorney a few years later. It was a position that was never held by a woman before her. She was currently serving her 5th term in office. During her years as a prosecutor, she worked on hundreds of cases, ranging from assault to sexual assault to child abuse to rape, and she was now focused on murder cases. She was a member of several boards, which included the Milton Rape Victims Advocates, the Milton Women's Shelter, the Milton Bar Association, and she was the president of the State District Attorneys Association. She was married for close to 40 years. She had 3 adult children and 5 grandchildren. Holt and Fisher were seated across from her as she read the evidence against Paul Gardner. They did not utter a single word until she was finished. Barrows was cheerful when it came to her family, but she was brutal when it involved her work. She removed her reading glasses and leaned back in her ergonomic leather chair. She glared at Holt.
"You should have spoken to me first before going in front of the cameras and giving a statement. I would have advised you against it."
Holt adjusted himself in his chair. He was not used to being scolded like a child, but those who dealt with Barrows had come to expect this.
"The evidence was overwhelming."
"Was it?" she asked, cutting him off.
"We found the suspect inside the house where the murder took place. We found blood on the suspect's clothing. And we found a bloody knife in the suspect's vehicle."
"Don't you find it a little suspicious that the suspect left the victim's body in her bedroom while he went to sleep in the guest house?"
Holt opened his mouth, but then shut it.
"Don't you find it even more suspicious that the suspect decided to leave the murder weapon in his vehicle rather than dispose of it someplace else?"
Holt was quiet.
"Now, as far as the blood on the clothing is concerned, the suspect may have not realized it was there."
After a brief moment of silence, Fisher spoke up.
"Are you saying we don't have a case?" "I'm not saying that, nor am I saying you shouldn't have charged Mr. Gardner. The facts are what they are, and you did your job. But I have to look at this case differently than you. I have to see if I can get a conviction. All the issues I just raised are ones the defense will raise as well."
She leaned on the desk.
"We need to be prepared for this and for much more, especially now that Mr. Gardner has retained Evan Roth."
Holt now understood the prosecutor's concerns. Roth was one of the most ruthless defense lawyers in the city. Barrows had had her share of battles with him, and she did not win them all. He could tell she did not want to lose this one either. She said,
"If I know Roth, he will be seeking bail as soon as he gets in front of the judge."
"We can argue Gardner is a flight risk," Holt said.
"How?"
"His family is worth millions. He's got resources and connections. His father-in-law is a senator. Last year, he and his wife traveled to 3 countries."
"How do you know that?" Barrows asked.
"During our search of the house, we found their passports. And from the entry and exit stamps, we discerned when and where they went."
"How does that assist us?"
"We tell the judge that he has links to other countries."
Barrows thought a moment.
"Where did they go last year?"
Holt looked over at Fisher for assistance. Fisher squinted and said,
"I think it was South Africa, the Cayman Islands, and Switzerland."
Barrows considered this.
"If my memory serves me correct, all 3 of those countries have extradition treaties with the United States."
"But 2 of those countries are known for their lax banking policies."
Barrows shook her head.
"It may not be enough to deny bail. Get me something I can take to the judge."
Chapter 18. Calloway returned to the beach house feeling a little deflated. He had a duty to let his client know what he had found. What his client did with that information was up to him. Calloway always completed the job he was hired for. If he could not, or if he failed due to his own actions, he would refund the client's money. That was the right thing to do. He never understood why he was always struggling for money, when over the years he was fortunate enough to snag rich clients. But debts always followed him, and the debts were not all owed to financial institutions. Some of his loans had come from shady people, and they did not believe in installment payments, waiving interest, or loan forgiveness. What they wanted was the money, in cash and on time. Any deviation from those rules meant physical harm would come his way. Calloway always tried to pay off his debts. In some cases, he had no choice, but whenever he was clear of one debt, he somehow managed to take on another. Once, after completing a job for the wife of a politician, which resulted in a nice payday, Calloway was feeling good about himself. Instead of depositing the money in the bank like regular folks did, he decided to try his luck at the racetrack. He was only going to bet on one or two races. He did not, and he ended up wasting virtually all the money. Seeking to lick his wounds, he decided to get a drink at the racetrack bar. When he was in between shots of whiskey, he overheard a group of people at the next table talking about a guaranteed investment. They were bankers, and they knew a way to get a high rate of return in the stock market. Calloway, reeling from his latest self-inflicted financial loss, decided to invest with them. He wanted something that was secure and that would replenish his pockets. But there was a problem. Thanks to blowing his latest payday, he had no money to invest. So he did what he always did whenever he needed a quick loan, went to individuals who had criminal records to borrow money. After he made his investment with the bankers, he felt he could pay these new debts back in no time. What he did not know at the time was that the FBI was already investigating the bankers for an alleged Ponzi scheme. A few days after Calloway handed the bankers the money, they were arrested. The money disappeared, probably to some numbered account in the islands, and with it, his hope of ever getting the money back and the return he was promised. He then spent the next several months taking on any job that came his way, no matter how menial. If someone wanted him to find their lost pet, he did it. Anything to pay back the loan he had taken. Paul Gardner was a good client. He said he had found him through an online search. Calloway believed him. Paul gave him the first installment of his pay without asking too many questions. All he wanted was evidence that his wife was cheating on him. Calloway was hoping he would spend a week or two trailing Paul's wife. The billable hours would have racked up to some serious cash. Calloway had no opinion on Paul's current predicament. Whether he was guilty or not was to be determined in court, not by him. Calloway just did not want to be caught in the middle. That was all he wanted. If any fingers pointed in his direction, he could always plead the fifth. He did not hear anything, he did not know anything. He was just an innocent bystander, somehow caught up in the mess. He sighed. With the gardener job over, he would have to find more work. He checked his phone and realized there was a message for him. He frowned when he saw who it was from. On any other day, he would have ignored the message or deleted it. But today was not that day. He dialed the number. Chapter 19. A court-appointed officer was standing by the Gardner residence's front door when Holt and Fisher drove up. The officer's duty was to make sure the detectives did not tamper with something that might turn out to be evidence. There had been cases of detectives returning to the scene of a crime and planting evidence favorable to the prosecution. The chance of this occurring on a regular basis was rare, almost never, but even one time could taint the entire legal system. A suspect was entitled to due process that should be fair and impartial. Holt and Fisher signed a piece of paper, and the officer held the front door open for them. They pulled on latex gloves and began the arduous task of combing through the house, looking for clues. They could not split up because there was only one officer at the scene. They had to work in tandem as they first went through the guest house, and then the kitchen where the murder weapon was taken from. They then moved to the bedroom, where Kyla Gardner's body was discovered. The two detectives were not sure what they were looking for, but they would know it once they saw it. Half an hour later, they had come up empty. Anything that was of use had already been tagged, photographed, and taken as evidence. Even Paul Gardner's Audi had been towed to a police facility in order to be stripped for further clues. Holt pulled off his gloves. "This was a waste of time," he grumbled. Fisher said, "We still haven't checked the office." "And what do you expect to find in there?"
"I don't know, but we should take a look."
"You do that while I go sit down." He saw the officer staring in his direction. There was no way Holt could be in the living room while Fisher was in the office. "Fine," Holt huffed, "but make it quick." Fisher went through the room. Holt looked on, his arms crossed over his chest, feeling the slow burn of impatience. The officer stood next to him, keeping his eyes on Fisher, as he pulled open the drawers, ruffled through the documents inside, then moved on. She picked up a couple of envelopes, and after taking a quick look, she put them away. She opened a couple of banker's boxes, but all she saw were invoices and statements related to Gardner's business.
"You done? Can we go now?"
Holt asked. He was normally very methodical on the job, but when he became disinterested, he was prone to childish exasperation. Fisher was about to leave when something caught her eye. She moved to the bookshelf in the corner. A yellow piece of paper was stuck between two hardcover books. She pulled the paper out and unfolded it. A smile crossed her face when she saw what it was. She turned and held the paper out for Holt to see. He examined the printed words and said,
"It might just do. Good job, Fisher."
She informed the officer of their intentions. The officer pulled out a Ziploc bag, placed the document inside, and made a note of the discovery for the record. Chapter 20. Roth stared at Judy Barrows. He found her intimidating, but he kept his feelings hidden. Barrows' courtroom exploits were well known among the legal community, and even if you had not seen her in action, you had heard of her. Roth had won a few cases against her, but it still did not diminish the effect she had on him. She was relentless, determined, and tough as nails. If you did not bring your A-game, she would eat you alive. There were too many lawyers whose careers were tarnished or destroyed by Barrows. They made the fatal mistake of underestimating her. They viewed this small woman as a pushover. What they got was an onslaught of legal expertise. Roth was determined never to make that mistake. In fact, if he could avoid going to battle with her, he would. So when she called him to discuss the Gardner case, he rushed over.
"Thank you for coming at such a short notice," she said.
They were seated across from one another on small sofas. They looked like two colleagues having a casual conversation. She had offered him coffee, and he had declined.
"It's no trouble," he replied. "I'm more than happy to oblige."
She smiled, but it was not affectionate.
"I thought it was better that we meet first before we get fully invested in the case."
"I agree.
I am going to ask the judge to deny bail,"
she said, quickly getting to the point. Roth was not the least bit surprised. This was a tactic used by most prosecutors in order to apply pressure on the accused. The longer they were locked up, the more they were willing to cut a deal, even if that deal sent them back to prison, albeit for a shorter period of time.
"On what basis?" he asked. "Your client is a successful businessman."
"All the more reason for him not to be a flight risk," Roth countered.
"He wouldn't leave behind everything he's worked so hard for." "But he does have connections and access to resources. Last year, he went on 3 trips overseas, to South Africa, the Cayman Islands, and Switzerland."
Roth was not aware of any trips, but he would confirm this with Paul later. He knew Barrows was preparing a case to convince the judge to deny bail, and that she wanted to see his rebuttals.
"All 3 have extradition treaties with the U.S., he said. "Yes, but I will argue that if he can visit those countries, what is stopping him from going elsewhere?"
Roth believed Barrows was grasping at straws, hoping one of them would achieve her objective. He said,
"I know people who have traveled to many more countries than that in a given year." "Many of those people are not charged with murdering their daughter."
He smiled. This was the opening he was waiting for.
"My client did not murder his daughter. He had no motive to harm her." "The motive will become known in due time," she said. "Your client was at the scene of the crime. The victim's blood was on him. The murder weapon was in his vehicle. When provided with these facts, a jury will return from their deliberations with a verdict of guilty. But when presented the other way, they may not," he said.
She waited for his explanation.
"It doesn't make sense that a man would kill his daughter, hide the weapon in his car, and then decide to stay on the premises and fall asleep. If he had committed the murder, should he not be fleeing the crime scene instead of going back? Maybe he decided to flee and had made it all the way to the car, but then realized he couldn't drive in his condition."
Roth was confused.
"Condition?" Your client had been drinking that night. A bottle of scotch was found in the guest house. He only consumed half a glass. So you say.
She was testing him. She wanted to see how hard he was willing to fight back. Barrows continued.
In his inebriated state, he decided to sleep it off, and thus was woken up by his wife the next day.
Roth could punch a dozen holes in her theory, but he was not willing to get into it now. He would leave that for when they were before a judge and jury.
Speaking of the wife, he said, if my client stayed put to sleep from the alcohol, as you say, wouldn't he have been worried his wife would eventually find out what he had just done? She did find out when she went into her daughter's room. Yes, but why didn't she hear anything during the night? He said. The couple's bedroom is next door to their daughter's. She couldn't, because she was under the influence of sleeping medication. His smile widened even more. She wasn't home that night.
Barrows was taken aback.
What?
Roth removed a set of photos from his briefcase and placed them before her.
These were taken on the night Kyla Gardner was murdered. You can see from the date stamp that Mrs. Gardner had left the house for almost 3 hours. My client could have used that as an opportunity to make his escape.
The surprise was still visible on her face.
Who took these?
There was no point in hiding the truth, Roth knew. Sooner or later, he would have to reveal this fact, whether it was now or through a judge's order.
My client was suspicious his wife was cheating on him, and to verify this, he hired a private investigator. I will be submitting these photos as evidence.
Barrow's face was grim. Roth was beaming on the inside. He had scored one for the defense. If the prosecutor was going to use Sharon Gardner as a witness against her husband, there was a strong possibility of this because the couple was in the process of divorcing. They would think twice now. She cleared her throat and said,
"We're not here to argue about your client's guilt. We'll have plenty of time for that. We are here to discuss whether he should be set free before the trial. My client is not a threat to himself or anyone else. If you go to the judge with what you've just told me, I guarantee the judge will grant my client bail."
Barrows smiled. Roth suddenly felt unnerved.
Detectives Holt and Fisher were at the scene of the crime, and they discovered something interesting.
He sat up in his seat. He now regretted not visiting the crime scene before he came here.
I hope everything was as it should be. It was. An officer appointed by the court made sure of that.
She opened a desk drawer and pulled out a plastic bag. Inside was a yellow piece of paper.
It's a purchase agreement between your client and a company located in Milton. It's dated less than a month ago.
Without looking at the document, he asked, "What's it for?"
Your client bought a small boat.
It was his turn to be taken by surprise, but he controlled his emotions as best he could.
Maybe he likes to fish. We found no fishing equipment in the house. In fact, your client doesn't even have a fishing license to his name. We will argue that it was all premeditated, and that after killing his daughter, your client had planned to sail away.
She dropped the bag on the desk.
I'll be filing this as evidence.
She had just scored one for the prosecution. The silence hung in the air as they both stared at each other, wondering who would blink first. Barrows said,
I'm willing to offer a plea deal. I already have too many cases on my desk that need my immediate attention. We will drop murder in the first degree, and instead go for a lesser charge if your client pleads guilty. He's only 46. He'll be out in 20 years and be able to resume his life. Let me think about it, Roth said.
Chapter 21. Calloway knocked on the steel door and waited. He was in a spot located behind a strip club. A second later, a small window slid open and two eyes appeared. He felt like he was in some bad cop movie.
What do you want? The man demanded.
Baxter, open the door. It's Lee Calloway, he replied, annoyed.
Who?
Do you want me to leave? I'll go. Then you'll have to answer to Mason.
A bolt was turned, a chain was removed, and the door was unlocked. Baxter was 6'4", 250 pounds of pure muscle, and he sported a buzz cut. He always wore a tight t-shirt, which made his big arms look even bigger. Calloway moved past him and went up the stairs. He could hear sounds from the club coming through the wall. He was confronted with another door. He waited as Baxter trudged up behind him. He was always surprised how the man was able to fit through the narrow stairs. It was Baxter's duty to let people in, with his boss's permission, of course. One time, Calloway barged in, and Baxter almost lost his mind. The man was a little loose in the head, Calloway figured, but he took his job seriously. He had to give him that. The office was small and narrow. A wide desk took up most of the space. A man was seated in a leather chair behind the desk. Mason was short, rail thin, and every inch of his arms was covered in tattoos. He sported a small goatee, and he wore wiry-rimmed prescription glasses.
"Lee, my friend," Mason said with a smile, "come in and have a seat."
"I didn't know I was your friend," Calloway said. Mason made a melodramatic gesture, acting as if Calloway had insulted him.
"You were always my friend."
Calloway shot a look at Baxter. "If I was your friend, then why was your guard dog ready to break my leg the last time I was in here?"
"That was business, you know that," Mason replied.
Calloway had found himself in a tight spot, and with nowhere else to go, he showed up at Mason's doorstep. Mason was more than willing to extend him the loan, but when Calloway fell behind, Mason sent Baxter to recoup the money. Fortunately, Calloway was able to talk his way out of serious injury.
"I've got a job for you," Mason said.
"I'm not taking any more jobs from you."
"You took the last one."
"Only because I owed you money."
"Listen, I'm interested in hiring you, Mr. Private Investigator."
Mason gave him a smile, which was anything but pleasant.
"I bet you need the cash. Why else would you be here?"
Calloway hated that Mason was right. Why could he not just get a stable 9-to-5 job and be done with dealing with lowlifes like Mason? "I only came to see what you wanted," Calloway said.
"Well, I want you to find someone for me."
"I bet this person owes you money."
"Yes."
"Then no thanks. I'm not going to find this person so Baxter can hurt him."
"We don't want to hurt him, Lee. He made an agreement with us, which he reneged on. We just want our money."
Calloway stared at him. Mason's expression hardened.
"We will find him, with or without your help."
Calloway did not like the sound of that.
"How much does he owe you?"
$10,000, but after interest and late penalties, it is $12,000. And if you collect in full, you keep 10%.
That's over $1,000, Calloway thought. That would come in handy right about now.
"What if he doesn't have the money?" Calloway said. "I'm guessing he doesn't, which is why he has become scarce."
"He owns a classic Plymouth Roadrunner. He put it up as collateral. It's got to be worth at least $20,000. You find him, you'll find the car."
Calloway thought Mason's offer over.
"Okay, I'll do it. But if I find him, you don't hurt him. You sell the car and get your money."
"That's what I keep saying. I just want my money, that's all," Mason said, spreading his arms out.
"What's his name?" Calloway finally asked.
Chapter 22. Paul Gardner shook his head. "I'm not pleading guilty. I did not kill my daughter." Roth was back at the Milton PD. After his meeting with Barrows, it was his duty to inform his client of all his options. Roth did not have to agree with them, and in some instances, he would wholly advise